Hello, this is Avish Parashar, the Motivational Smartass of MotivationalSmartass.com. And I am here chatting today with someone who is both a very good friend of mine and also someone who I consider to be really brilliant at all things related to marketing and sales and persuasion and all sorts of exciting stuff. And that is Kirsten Carey. Welcome, Kirsten.
Oh, thanks, Avish. I think you've completely overstated how brilliant our friendship is, actually.
Oh, really? Is that the way it goes?
I mean, it's still quite brilliant in my area of expertise.
I see. I guess I should have said I'm a good friend to her. I don't know how good a friend she is to me. So, I see. So we're starting off on the right foot. So, well, Kirsten, thank you for chatting with me today. What I want to talk about, and actually, we're going to talk about, well, me and my stuff.
Of course.
But as you know my stuff pretty well, so you know I've come up with this whole process of how to improvise with the unexpected and kind of how to make your responses automatic and reflexive. And, you know, it's not something that applies just to improvising on stage or even reacting unexpected, but one of the things I like about this stuff is that it's fundamental. And so we're going to chat about how this would apply to your area of expertise. And, you know, before we do that, why don't we get to the propaganda? Why don't you just share, you know, just a little bit about yourself and a little bit about your background so we know kind of what we're in store for here.
Sure. I have a degree in speech communications. I've owned, partnered with, or run 6 different businesses in the course of my lifetime. I own a real estate investment company. I use car lot. I'm a consultant and professional speaker myself. And I also was a partner in a legal courier service at one point and a promotional products company. So I've kind of done the gamut of owning businesses. But
so
I
you're basically the classic underachiever is what you're saying.
Right.
Okay.
With all of that being said, about 14 years ago I got involved with professional speaking as well as consulting other businesses to help them make more money and to spend less time doing it. So a lot of what I do is I really speak to audiences now almost specifically in creative fields. So caterers, decorative painters, graphic designers, people who are really creative and brilliant but don't necessarily have the business side down. And a lot of the things that I get into tend to be sales related. To me, it's more communication styles, understanding persuasion, the good mind manipulation, and there actually is good mind manipulation. But a lot of my clients would just tell you I was a business consultant or a sales consultant.
Gotcha. Now, you know, you said you spend a lot of time these days working with creative clients, but if we've got someone listening to this audio who isn't in a creative field, what you really do is, I mean, you've learned over the years and over your work how to apply those to the creative fields, but really we're talking about, again, like my stuff, fundamental communication skills that are going to lead to bigger and better sales, correct?
Right. And your items and the things that you talk about absolutely lean into sales, whether it's a creative business, a small business, a large business, corporate, it doesn't really matter. I just found that niching my company was just easier as far as marketing was concerned. But I've worked with all different types of businesses. Obviously, I've owned several of them too. But what you do is so crucial to successful communication, successful sales, and successfully building a business and making money.
Cool. I'm glad to hear that. And I just want to be sure people listening who are like, oh, well, you know, I don't paint, and they just, you know, turn it off. So this is stuff that's going to apply to everyone. And so good. Well, then why don't we just get right into it then?
Okay.
And, you know, I want to start with a more general question, and this is not one of the things I may have prepared you for, but,
okay.
You know, like
great.
To get some off-the-cuff answers. Yeah, we're improvising. So,
right from underneath her in the beginning.
Exactly. We start out that way that we can only go up from there. You know, you have you work with a lot of clients. You've spoken to large groups. You've spoken in small groups. You've worked one-on-one with a lot of people, I know. And then you've just had a lot of casual conversations, as I know, from a lot of people in various industries. So my question to you is, what do you think the stupidest thing that people are doing that's hurting themselves in terms of their sales and building their business?
The stupidest things. God, there's so many. We don't have that kind of time. But let me.
I know. Just pick like the one or two that jump right to your head.
The first thing that they do is they try to sell something. I know that sounds a little funny, but what most people are doing is they're getting out there and they've created a 30-second or 60-second sales pitch, and they've run in there and they've tried to convince the client they have to buy from them because of all these reasons. And they don't even for a second think that the client would need anything, want anything, or even hear their own voice. So the dumbest thing I see people doing is trying to jam information down the client's throat without first asking questions and figuring out what the client really wants, what the client really needs, and if whatever they're selling, the service or the product, is appropriate for that particular client.
And, you know, that's funny because I've known you for so long. That just seems so obvious to me in terms of, like, communication and sales. But you're right in that so many people get so eager to sell their stuff and think, you know, we all go into these businesses because we love what we do and we're so eager to let other people know about it, we forget that, you know, everyone kind of wants to, you know, talk about themselves and they're going to buy stuff that's going to help them the most.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and that's why what you do comes into play so quickly in the sales process is because you have to be asking questions and you have to know what to do with the information you're getting, and it's all basically off the cuff. I mean, it's just planned off the cuff. So what you do, teaching people how to really improvise, is really effective in the sales process because you have a general idea of what kind of information you want from people, but depending on how they answer, you have to go in a different direction.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Well, what's that?
That's probably the number one dumbest thing. Yeah.
Okay, I like that. So if you're listening to this, you know, next time you're in a sales meeting or, you know, just say to yourself, hey, this is dumb, I shouldn't do this, and you'll be fine.
Mm-hmm.
So what I've been doing for a little while now is, ironically, even though it's improvising and going with the flow, I discovered/developed a step-by-step process that you can train yourself to go through in any situation, whether it's an immediate short-term improvisation or your more long-term planning. You can apply this in the long term. And what I want to do is go through those steps with you and talk about how they might directly apply in these kinds of sales situations. And the way it's set up is the first two are mentalities that I try to get people conditioned to understanding all the time. And using those as their foundation, then there's the three steps that they can take to get themselves through any situation. So what I want to do is go through them with you and see how they might apply. And frankly, if they don't, I'm okay with you saying that. You know, I mean, I want you to tell me I'm the best thing since sliced bread, but if you don't agree, then, you know, be honest, and you know, we can have a dialogue about it.
No problem.
Okay, good.
Have I ever held back before?
What's that?
Have I ever held back before?
That's a fair point. Not that you've ever made me feel like the best thing since sliced bread before, so... That's good, but this is recorded, so you know there's gonna be evidence of this now. Finally. All right, let's get started. So the two mentalities. The first key mentality when it comes to improvising is to have fun. And when I talk about this, it means when the unexpected happens, it's instead of giving in to despair, it's finding ways of enjoying yourself, it's keeping your energy up and staying positive. And I find that as kind of this attitude that really allows you to be flexible and move forward. Now, to me, and I'll admit this, it's one of the reasons I keep coming to you for advice, is in general, I don't find sales fun. And so I work towards that myself. And to me, it seems like the perception of some of the salespeople is they're like beating you up and, you know, the traditional stereotypical person. So is having fun an important thing in what you consider to be this sales communication process?
Oh, it's crucial. And I equate fun with passion. I see the two of them to be pretty much synonymous. And
mm-hmm.
I really believe if you're not having fun, then you're doing something very wrong. So, and if you don't have passion for whatever it is you're selling, you're not going to be able to sell it effectively. If you have passion for what it is you're selling, I can absolutely teach you how to sell. But if you have sales skills and no passion, there's no way to really teach somebody that. So I think this is absolutely the most crucial thing to effective selling, is that you have to have fun and you have to have passion for what it is that you're selling.
Interesting. Now, do you think so you've come across, say, artists and whatnot who they clearly love what they do.
Yep.
And you've probably had to go through this dialogue with them where they hate selling. Mm-hmm. They're not having fun doing it. Is there anything that you may have said to them or anything you consistently say to people to get them to that place?
To get them to have a good time selling?
Well, yeah, I mean, I agree with you that fun, having fun is having passion. And sometimes I think people forget that. So do you have any ways that people can remember to not focus on, like, this negative thing and let their passion come out when they're selling?
Well, a lot of times I break them of the concept of what they think sales is. A lot of times people think selling is knocking on doors and pounding pavements and trying to convince somebody who doesn't need what you need, what you have, to buy from you. It's, you know, people will say things to me like, oh, I guess you can talk a dog off a meat wagon, or you can sell, you know, ice cubes to an Eskimo. And I said, why would you want to do that? They already have ice, and the dog doesn't, you know, need to be talked off a meat wagon. Find the people in the Sahara that don't have any ice and sell to them. So, you know, it really changed their mindset on who they should be selling to and why they should be selling, and that they're really essentially doing a disservice to people by not helping them purchase from them when they need it. So it changes their mindset that they're trying to do something nasty or dirty or bad. And that right there is pretty much the changeover, that they're actually hurting people by not selling to them when they need the service or the item that they provide.
You know what's funny about this, and this is one of those, I think, tangents, which I said was okay when we talked about doing this call before. And I think I'm going to actually get more directly to this when we get into some of the steps. But something you're saying really is ringing out to me, something I've been thinking about my own business and a few other things, is that a lot of times it's this almost a scarcity versus abundance mentality in that, and you can tell me if I'm off base here, but it's, you know, if you feel like you only have one prospect, even if they're not a good one, you're going to get so stressed out about it, and you're going to be, if it's not a good prospect, but it's the only person in front of you, you might drive yourself crazy, you know, like you said, trying to force someone to buy something you don't want, as opposed to just reaching out and drawing those people to you who would be good prospects.
Yep, absolutely. And they're usually going after the wrong people. They don't understand who their market is. They're trying to sell to everyone. Which, again, is why I have a specific niche. It's not that I can't help other business owners, and I have. It's just that I just found that these people that are in creative fields tended to need me more, and they had a higher idea of value for me. So much of what people think is sales is not. It's really just asking the right questions, getting to what the client needs, and finding out if you're actually the right person to be selling them your product or your service. And that's it. It's not trying to convince somebody who doesn't need what you have to buy. And there's a fine line between the two, but it's worlds apart.
Right. So what we were looking at then to kind of tie this first point up is there's two things to do. Number one is when you're going into that situation is to have fun. And by the way you do that is to change your tactics. So instead of trying to do something you hate, it's just having a conversation, finding out whether you're a good fit.
Yeah.
And on the flip side, it's before you're in that situation, it's to set yourself up to win. It's to set yourself up to go into situations where you can have fun.
Right.
And as opposed to trying to turn every, you know, setting yourself up to go into, like, you would never advocate someone go, like, you worked with muralists before. You would never advocate they go door-to-door knocking on the door saying, hey, you know, let me try to sell you my muralist services.
Yeah. No, absolutely not. And then the other side of it is also that they always think that they need to be selling themselves the whole time and convincing the client to buy something. When there's a second part of it, it's seeing if that client's right for you and if they're somebody you want to work with as well. And once I gave my clients permission to actually look at the client as someone they are looking at meeting with just to decide if they want to work with them, it changed a lot of things too, because it wasn't one-sided anymore. It was as if they were working together as a team to decide if they were the right people for each other.
Right, and what I like about that is when you start looking as to whether this is a good client for you, you start valuing yourself and valuing your own fun. I mean, I realize that, you know, sometimes you gotta do what you gotta do to make money. But I think the more we put ourselves in situations that we're gonna enjoy and let our passion come out and have fun, the more successful we're gonna be.
Yeah, one of the questions I ask my clients in the beginning when they're trying to determine who their client base really should be is, what type of clients do you really enjoy working with, and which type of clients do you not? And the mind shift that they go through when they sit there and say, oh, my gosh, I can pick people that would be fun to work with, changes the entire situation. And sales becomes fun because they're looking for people that they can have fun with and they enjoy working with and they can't wait to work with, which changes a lot. So fun is crucial, absolutely crucial.
Great. Now, there is a novel concept you want to work with. Oh, yeah, right. okay. So now let's go to the second mentality. So the first mentality, when I teach people about being able to improvise and have fun, the second one is almost the flip side of that, which is to be willing to fail. Now, I'm not saying that failure is okay, and I'm not saying failure doesn't have consequences. What I mean is to go into situations understanding that you may not succeed and not letting that hold any power over you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I saw this in improv comedy all the time where people get nervous or taking the stage and they start stressing over things they couldn't control, and we'll get to that in a little bit. So how important, and this is one of those ideas that a lot of people, it's kind of new to them when I talk to them sometimes about it, and they're not sure about it. So I'm curious, how important do you think that willingness to fail is in this context?
Failing is also crucial. One of the things that I use as kind of a guideline for my clients to understand if they're doing the right thing when it comes to their proposal writing, because proposals to me are part of the sales process.
Mm-hmm.
When they write their proposals, if they're closing more than 75% of their proposals, I think that they're doing something wrong. And, of course, I have clients who will come to me and say, you know, I close every person I ever meet with. And I said, then you're not charging enough, and you're doing something wrong if you're closing them all, because you're not failing enough, which means you're not pushing the envelope enough. So you're absolutely not charging enough, because if nobody's saying no to you, there's a problem. So
right.
I think most of my clients should be closing between 50 and 75% of the people that they send a proposal to. So they need to be failing at least 25% of the time, as far as I'm concerned.
That's interesting. So not only are you saying that you need to be willing to fail, you're actually saying that if you're not failing, you're not doing enough.
Yeah, you're not pushing enough. You're too afraid. You're not doing the right thing, and you're not going after difficult customers. Not difficult as far as they're a pain in the neck to work with, but you know, you're not reaching. You're not pushing the envelope. You're not charging more, and you're probably undercharging yourself. You're probably not getting the bigger clients or the better types of clients that you want to work with, because you're not getting a no somewhere along the line. One out of every four, at least, should be saying no to you.
Hmm. Now, how in your experience in dealing, because I'm sure you've encountered this, where you try to get, you know, you're talking to an artist who's probably undercharging for their services, because
mm-hmm.
a lot of
they
artists do
are.
That. Yeah, they all are. Every one of them is.
And
really, frankly, a lot of people in a lot of industries are undercharging.
Yes.
And they've got that fear of failure in that, you know, they'd rather hit all their contracts for, they'd rather hit 10 contracts for 100 than bump that up to 500, because they're afraid, like, oh, well, what if I get none? So how do you address that fear? Because that's really that fear of failure. Like, oh, well, if I raise it so high that some people are going to not take it, what if no one takes it? So how have you in the past, when you've encountered a client, addressed that?
Well, I mean, we go through a process where we sit down and we say, you know, how much money do you have to make this month to make your bills, and what do you have to do? And we really sit down and look at the past projects that they've worked on before. One of the things I put them through is to say, okay, let's pull the projects you've worked on in the last 24 months. And looking back at those projects, should you have charged more? Based on client pain in the ass, I call it the PETA fee, the pain in the ass fee.
Nice.
How much of a PETA was that client? And should you have charged more for it? How much did you undercut yourself? And we go through that process. So I more shift them away from fear-based decision making to what do we know and what have you done in the last 24 months and should you have charged more or not. And majority of the time, on I would say 90% of the projects, they come back and say, I should have charged more. Knowing what I know now, I should have charged more. So we start putting the PETA fees in there. We start putting in the miscellaneous, I didn't see this coming kind of factoring into the process. And then they start, they aren't willing to go under a certain amount. And they start getting really good at talking about numbers and talking about fees and talking about prices, which is where most of the problem comes in. Because most of this country, most of us are afraid to talk about numbers. Money is like such a horrible thing. So that's where I usually go in a slightly different way. But it's usually looking back at what you've done in the past, should you have charged more? And most of the time it was yes.
Right. Well, that's funny, because you just saying that makes me think of two things. Number one is I love the PETA, the pain in the ass fee, because I think something you'll agree with is that a lot of times the prospect that's going to beat you up on price is ironically going to be the biggest pain in the ass.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
You know, like the one that comes to you and says, this is, you know, you if you raise your fee to what you think you're really valuing yourself, the ones that come to you and just say, yeah, I see the value, I'm going to take that. The ones that want a discount, holy cow, they're the ones who then beat you up for, like, the whole project.
It's a huge red flag from the beginning, a huge red flag.
Now, this is not to say, for those of you listening who may have hired me at some point in the past, you were wonderful, I love you. I'm talking hypothetically, let's just say.
Right,
things I've heard about other clients and other people.
No, it's absolutely, there's a big difference between them just beating you up on price and getting nothing, and it's painful when you realize you've done it. And when you just allow a client to say, how about you take less, and you say, okay, that's when it all goes bad. But if they say, how about you take less, and you say, okay, how about I take something away from the contract at that point, that's a negotiation. But when a client says, how about you take less, and you say, okay, that's a gift. And when you gift clients like that, they don't respect you anymore. So it's very, that's not failing to me. That's just a mess.
And I think the other thing you're giving your clients, which I hope everyone takes from this when I try to get people to do when talking about willingness to fail, is that perspective by looking back at their own history. Because sometimes we don't realize how many times we failed and really, you know, the good that's come out of that, how we stretched ourselves. And you know, one thing I like to say is if you think about anything you really excel at in your life, chances are you approach that with an attitude of passion and fun. And also, you're not afraid to mess it up.
Yep.
And the stuff in your life that you're really bad at is the reverse. You take it way too seriously. You don't think about it in fun terms. And you're probably terrified of messing it up.
You know, it's interesting. I have a client who is a muralist. She actually teaches classes on mural design and painting. And one of the things that she started doing with her clients because of that exact issue, the afraid to mess it up thing, is she told clients at the her students at the beginning of class, she said, "We're throwing everything away today at the end of class. You're not keeping anything." So she said that their creativity went out the roof when she started telling them that in the beginning of class. But when they thought they were taking the items home to finish or to be finished by the end of class, they were afraid to be more freestyle and they were afraid that they were going to mess things up. But when she had them crumpling up paper and tossing it at the end, she said their creativity was so much more amazing and they were so much better at painting.
See, to me that's so funny because these are people who are taking a class.
Yep.
So, like, it's not like, it's not a client, right? So, I mean, they can make these own rules themselves, but a lot of us just need, I think I've heard you say this a lot, we just need permission in a lot of these cases.
Yep, and it was brilliant for her to do that. And when they thought they were throwing things away, it was different than when they thought they were keeping something. And she said the paintings came out so much better when they thought they were tossing because they were free to screw up.
Yeah, so I think it's giving yourself permission. It's making it okay to fail. And maybe even practice, like you said, stretch yourself. Put yourself in situations not that are going to take you out of that fun zone like we talked about in the first point. But, you know, stretch yourself a bit so that, you know, facing some failure, because that's basically when you're hitting your comfort zone and your ceiling, and by bumping up against that, you're going to push that out.
Yep.
All right, cool. Well, I mean, I feel like we've covered a lot just on the two mentalities, but I want to get into the what I call the three steps to really improvise with anything. Now, the way I position these is that whenever something unexpected happens, if you go through these steps immediately after building a foundation of fun and willingness to fail, you can. This is what improv comedians do on stage, and this is what great improvisers do in life. But as I said at the beginning of this call, that this is foundational, and you can apply these steps in a broader sense, not just, you know, when the ding hits the fan, as I like to say. So I'm going to take you through these three steps, and just like we do with the other two, just see what your thoughts are on them. So the very first step, the very first thing I tell people to do instantly when the unexpected happens is to first immediately focus on their outcomes as opposed to first on outcomes, second on the process or the details. And I've shared them in other contexts, so I won't, but I'm pretty sure this applies to sales because I've messed this up myself before in sales context. So, but just, you know, what are your thoughts on that first point?
This is actually, I think I even mentioned this in the beginning of the call. What you asked me what the dumbest thing people do, and I said they go in there and they just try and pitch an idea and shove down the client's throat what it is that they're selling. But they have to ask questions. But they have to ask questions in a way that they know what they're trying to get to, but that they know how to then improvise throughout the conversation to handle how the client is responding. So that's perfect because they have to know what the outcome is that they're looking for. What kind of information are they really trying to obtain from the customer? So they have to have an idea of where they're going, though how they're getting there kind of changes in the middle, which is, I guess, the details in the process.
Right, right. And then even beyond that, sometimes it's really, you can take this step, you can take for granted because it's like, oh, well, sure, I know my outcome is to close a sale, but I think a lot of times people forget that, you know, your outcome isn't necessary to close this sale. You know, it's to, like you said, it's to have fun. It's to set yourself up to be with someone who you're going to enjoy working with. And, you know, a lot of times people may even talk themselves out of bigger sales because they're so fixed on getting just this, like, one project right in front of them.
Right.
And, you know, I know you know, we talked a little bit about, before we got in the process, about the questioning and the making sure you're asking. And, I know you're big into this with some of the consulting work you've done and some of the work you've done helping other people. sell consulting. So take us through a situation or share your thoughts from your experience when someone does go in saying, oh, you know, I'm going to get this project for $500 or $1,000. And, you know, do you have any historical experience how by not fixating on that outcome, but by rather going in and staying open to the big picture, which is the real goal is to serve the best way, how that turned into a much bigger project?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I've had this happen to me where, I mean, I've even had clients tell me that their budgets were $10,000 to $15,000, and I've walked away with $25,000 to $35,000 contracts because I didn't focus on their budget, so to speak. I focused on what the issue was and what the problems were, and I just asked a bunch of questions. And the more questions I asked, the client then realized there were more problems than they realized. And it wasn't me walking in and saying, I know you have a problem here. It was me saying, what's this? What's this? Explain this to me. What makes you think this is a problem? And that's all I was doing. And what happens is the client then starts to see what the issue is and what the problem is on his or her own terms. Because you're just asking questions. And a lot of times you know what their problem is, but by walking in and saying, your problem is this, they don't respond the same way as if you said, what about this, this, and this, and they come to it on their own. So you can't focus on just, you know, the money. You have to focus on what their problem is, what their issues are, and what they're trying to accomplish and why. Because if what they're trying to accomplish is only going to cost them, what their problem is only costing them $5,000 or $10,000 and your solution is $50,000, what's the point? The problem is fine.
Right. Well, I can tell you that on the flip side, you know, especially in my early days, you know, before I met you, of course, where I tell you there's multiple times. When I first started out, I started doing a lot of team building, as a lot of us do, and especially when you have something fun like improv comedy. And I can think of more than one instance where someone hired me to go in and do a team building. And so, of course, I took it without asking all the in-depth questions I probably should have. And, you know, when you do sit down with the decision maker, they'll say things like, oh, you know, our people, they need better morale, they're not communicating well, and blah, blah, blah. And then you get in there for the team building, and you discover that really most of their complaints are with the decision maker or with the manager. And, you know, again, not that I'm talking about anyone who might be listening to the show, but you know, that's one of the classic outcome things. So it was really a, you know, what turned out to be a one-off fee for a short team building thing, which, you know, back then may not even have solved the problems they wanted to because, just like you said, I didn't have that bigger picture outcome in mind to dig deeper in the preliminary stages.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, it's just really understanding. I mean, I had a client one time hire me because they wanted me just to come in, look at their training manual, and do a half a day training for them. And when I started asking them more questions about how they knew they were going to be successful, you know, what kind of measurements were they using, what, you know, how are they getting to the, I mean, how will they know they're going to be successful in a half a day, a full day, how they knew the people who were going through the training were going to be successful overall, what kind of measurements they were doing over a long period of time, how that was affecting them now. The guy was just floored, and then he turned around and ended up hiring me to first determine how they were going to measure the success, come up with a system on how they were going to implement that, and then actually recreate their entire first and second level training programs throughout the entire company. So we went from this rinky-dink little half-a-day training program to this six-month consulting project, which, again, I wasn't trying to convince him to go one way or the other. He finally turned to me and said, well, I don't know how to do any of this stuff. Can you do that for me too? And I said, sure.
That's perfect.
Yeah.
Now, I'm pretty sure I know the story because you told me the story before. Mm-hmm. And what's funny is, you know, when the style of selling you're talking about, which is really where your outcome really is just to uncover needs and find out if you're the right person for them, as opposed to sales tactics, you know, we're talking outcomes versus techniques and tactics and process. You're able to be more transparent. A lot of people don't like selling because, you know, you don't want to feel like you're trying to pressure someone. You don't want to use any of those slimy sales tactics. And what I love about this story, if I recall correctly, is the person called you in because they saw you do a workshop on this topic.
Yeah, I know where you're going.
And they called you in, and as you're just doing your thing, the guy stops and says, hey, this is what you told us to do in the workshop, right? So it's like he basically knew exactly what you were doing, but since you weren't really doing a tactic, you were just having a conversation. It was totally natural, not offensive, and it's not like you were caught doing something.
No, I gave them five things that they should always ask in every sales call ever. No matter who they were meeting with, there were five things that they always should be asking. And I asked him all five of them. And by the third one, his, you know, he could see his brain was kind of functioning much more quickly, like, wait a minute, something's going on here. And when I hit the fourth one, he stopped and he said, wait a minute, you're using your stuff on me. And I said, what stuff? He goes, the five questions. And I said, right. And he goes, you're asking. And he was excited. It was funny. And I said, yeah, of course I do. I don't just teach this stuff. I actually use it. It works. He goes, this is brilliant. And then he was really excited. So it couldn't have been any more transparent. And he loved it. And I was asking him exactly what he needed to be asked. And he knew it. But again, it just led right into more of, I knew even more of what I was talking about, and I was even more the person for them to work with. And it just was a great little cycle for me.
And you know what's funny here, though, and one of the reasons I like this foundational approach is because it allows for flexibility. And what I mean by that is, tactically, and you know, this might even make things sound a little bad, but tactically, you know, you got to, knowing the outcome, what is your real outcome, I think is important, because I got caught up in this consulting mindset just because, you know, from talking to you and other people and listening to how you could turn a small contract into a giant contract, you know, realize that part of your outcome is being happy. And it took me a couple of years to really accept the fact that that shouldn't be one of my outcomes. Not that I don't want to uncover real needs and dig deeper on things. But, you know, I would go in thinking I was looking for a bigger outcome when really I had a very specific thing in mind, like, oh, I want to turn this potential 1 gig into a 6-month thing.
Yep.
As opposed to, A, really focusing on what the client needed, and B, really focusing on what I needed as important an outcome as the other.
Yes.
I mean, I kind of stopped crying to go for the consulting because I'm like, you know what I want to do? I want to do a keynote speech, and that's what I do best, and that's where my passion is.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want people listening to this to think that it's all about the tactic of, you know, if you're selling consulting work, you know, you're selling solutions like that, then absolutely. And I think digging deeper is very important, but, you know, don't forget your own role in that as well.
Right. Well, I actually did a reverse to a client one time, which, you know, other salespeople will probably be like, what, are you mad? But I think there's some goodwill involved.
You talked them down
as well.
From a bigger contract?
I talked them, yeah, because they apparently were looking at like 15 different companies, and somebody knew me on the board, and they asked me as a favor to come in and even quote this project, because it was a project I didn't necessarily want to get involved with, but again, it was one of those somebody I knew, favor kind of thing. And I normally charge a whole lot more for what it is they were asking, but when I got in there and I started asking them questions, they thought they needed some big, gigantic PR campaign and that they were going to have to spend a whole bunch of money, and they were trying to find donors. And it was a nonprofit, too, just to make it a big charity, children's charity. So they're talking about spending this obscene amount of money on a PR project that once I got involved and started asking them questions about how their marketing and their sales worked, I realized their biggest problem was their core marketing was basically broken. So even if they had done a very successful PR campaign, it was going to fall apart when it came back to how they process the money, how they ask for the money, and everything else. So it was actually going to hurt them long term because the basics weren't fixed. So I went in there and told them for basically 20% of what they were going to spend, they could get what they needed and be much more successful by spending about 20% of it. And they didn't really believe me, I don't think, in the beginning, because they kept saying, why is she trying to talk us down? but it ended up working out really well, and then they actually ended up opening up a few more cans of worms while I was in there, realizing that they had some other things that were broken. So we were able to fix a lot of their marketing issues without them spending an obscene amount of money on PR campaigns. They weren't ready for it. And again, when you find out that from the client, now they ended up hiring me back for other projects after that. So it wasn't
right,
like,
because you also appreciated the potential long-term relationship as opposed to let me take more money than I rightfully should right now. You realize that, you know, let me do what's right, and then that led to
right, and then, cause
more
money
overall.
Even if we had done the other project, they weren't going to have satisfied the end result that they told me they wanted, and I was going to be the one that was going to be responsible for that, you know? So
yeah.
They were going to fail, even though I told them they were going to fail if they had gotten it that way, and it would have been my fault. So I think that's another thing you have to look at, no matter what it is that you're selling, is if the client isn't going to get what they need out of whatever it is they're doing, no matter how much they're paying you for it, you really need to do what's right for the client, and it's going to help you long term.
Wow, so interesting. So, yeah, sometimes talking them down is in your best interest as well.
Yeah. I mean, on that first project, but they came back for another 2 years and hired me for other projects.
Oh, there you go. Okay, let's move on to the second step, which is once you kind of know what your outcome is, the key is to when I teach people to improvise, whether on stage or off, it's to really let go of everything you can't control and just focus on what you can. Because a lot of times people get caught up in worrying about what the other person is going to say or do, or some external circumstance, or they're dwelling on something from the past or obsessing about something in the future. So I found for me, when it comes to improvising in any context, this is probably the most critical one. It's to really just focus on your own actions, the things that are in your control.
Mm-hmm.
So now how about in a sales conversation, sales communication context?
Well, I mean, a lot of times when people are in the sales process, they try to say yes to everything. They try to say, oh, yeah, I can do that. Yeah, I can do that. Yeah, I can do that. And if it's not in your scope of knowledge, you have no business getting involved with that stuff. And I think this is where salespeople they shoot themselves in the foot because they overpromise, and then they end up being forced to underdeliver. And this is perfect. I think it's absolutely in your best interest to say, yep, that's what I do, and that's what I do really well. When the client says, how about doing this for us, saying, you know what, that's not my area of expertise. How about I recommend someone else? How about I pull in somebody else into the project that's more appropriate for that, and then getting out of the way? And if you can't control it, it's not your area of expertise not to do it.
Interesting. Now, I think actually it sounds like this sounds like it applies a little more to step five, so why don't we talk about that for a second, and then we'll come back to step four, step three, I guess, is the fifth part of the five-part process, is, and you know this well, one of the main principles I talk about with improv is after you focus on what you can control, it's to say yes and instead of yes but. And, you know, right now, if you're listening, you might think this is contradictory because you're saying, oh, they say, you know, people shouldn't say yes all the time. And I agree, yes and isn't a literal thing where you're going to just say yes to everything out of your control. But I think the flip side is, you know, I think you said a great thing there. It's like, let me recommend someone, or maybe let me bring someone in. And I think you've probably been in a situation or heard of situations where someone in a sales conversation will yes but themselves out of potential work they could oversee or involve others in because they're so fixed in this limited range of thought.
Yep.
You know, so someone comes in and says, hey, can you do X, Y, and Z, and you only do X, and you'll just discount Y and Z and say, yeah, but I can't do that.
Right.
As opposed to thinking creatively about that third option.
Right. Right. And you have to think bigger because if you bring in somebody else, you may lose a couple of dollars there, but you're going to stay as the good consultant or the good person that gave them what they needed. If you try and do it and screw it up, it's worse. But always looking for a way to solve the problem the way the client wants, and also continuing to ask the client why they think it's a problem. They'll say, you know, we have to get my favorite one of my clients is, I need more new clients. And I'll say, why do you think you need more new clients? And they'll say, because my business is down. And I'll say, well, what are you doing with your old clients? And a lot of the times the problem really is that they're not making their current customers happy, where they could have gotten more business out of them. So the problem there is that they think they have a problem that they don't have, or they think it's the wrong solution. So, you know, just continuing to ask, well, yeah, that might be a problem, and how do you know that? So there's the yes, and how do you know that?
Yeah, and I think this is, and this goes back to your thing about how you don't go in and lay down the solution, which is if someone says, you know, I think I need more clients, if you said to them, you don't need more clients, you know, what you need to do is get more from the clients you have. I mean, some people may respond to that, but a lot of people, like you said before, if you just lay that right at them, they're going to be resistant to it.
Mm-hmm.
But that yes, and it says, okay, yes, I see you want more clients, and what do you think that's going to get you? And then they'll give you the next answer.
Yep.
And that allows you to just keep digging deeper and deeper.
But that is so in line with improv, because you have to know when you can shift and when you can't, and how to flow that through very easily. And not just have a written list of questions that you only use these questions. You have to know how to react to the client. So that's why I love it, the way that you do stuff, and why improv is, I think, crucial to sales in general.
Oh, well, thank you. Let's hope the rest of the world agrees.
If you don't have good improv skills, you're not going to be that good at communicating effectively, especially in the sales process.
Right, and, you know, one of the reasons yes and is the last step in the process, because you have to set it all up first. I mean, like you said, you know people who just have agreed to projects. Maybe they were desperate for the money, or maybe they just were afraid to. You know, sometimes it's weird. You go in there to a prospect, and they make you an offer, and you, like, are afraid to say no.
Yep.
Even though it's not, like, the exact deal you want or the details you wanted, but, like, oh, well, they made you an offer. I need to say yes to it. And, you know, yes and isn't about saying yes to everything. It's about, like you said, flowing, redirecting, and digging deeper.
Yep,
and that's
exactly
what's going to really make you happy.
Mm-hmm. Which is
cool,
more
so
fun.
Me, Yes, and then all, see, that's the thing, it all ties together, and that's the problem. That's why I like the foundational stuff, because tactically, if you try to do any one of these things, you know, you might make a little progress, but you might screw yourself over.
Yep.
So let me step back just a bit to the third step, or the second step, which was to focus on what you can control. And just in the context of improv, what I mean by that is, you know, you're having a communication with a person, and, you know, all you can control is what you say. You know, you can't, as much as we can influence and hope, we can't change what the other person does or says. And, you know, this may be one of those where you haven't delved in too much with some of your clients, but, I mean, do you feel that that's an important distinction for people to remember when they're talking to someone in a sales conversation?
That, yeah, I mean,
to not worry about the stuff
wrong.
They can't cover.
Yeah, if the guy you're dealing with is a jerk or there's something else going on, I mean, I have clients, again, who continue to ask me, how do I make this guy respond to me? How do I make him return my call? How do I make him buy from me? I'm like, you can't make anybody do anything. You can only control your own responses and your own behaviors. So if that person is acting like an idiot or that person is acting like a jackass, there's nothing you can do to force him or her out of his or her personality. So these are things you just need to let go, and you can only control how you do it. Now, you can alter how you behave to see if it alters his or her behavior, but you can't make them do anything. And that's, to me, is one of the things you have to know going into things, no matter what situation you're in, no matter what communication it's in, whether it's sales or not. So I think mm-hmm. it's brilliant for you to just be like, you know what, he's a jerk. Let it go. Move on. Not my client.
Yeah, and it's you know, and to be honest, that is easier said than done. But it's something I think that is well worth practicing and developing.
Yep.
And not just in sales, really, in any situation. I mean, I find the people in the world who are the most stressed out, like the freakazoids.
Yep.
They're the ones who are constantly stressed about stuff that's out of their control. Whether it's other people they can't control, or the economy, or the weather, or whatever. You know, it's just a fast path to stress and unhappiness.
There's a Jimmy Buffett song called Breathe In, Breathe Out, Move On.
Oh, I like that.
I love this song, and it's very zen, it's very calming, and but there the whole song talks about him buying a watch from the crazy old man, and the watch just says now. It doesn't have hands on it, it just says now. And the warranty says breathe in, breathe out, move on. And I think it's hysterical, but it's one of those songs that I like. I have it in my iPod that plays on a pretty regular basis, especially if I'm doing yoga, because it just reminds me I can't control everything. It's not my fault. Even if it is, there's nothing I can do about it. You breathe in, you breathe out, you move on, and you continue with life. And I think this is the perfect example of that song, or the song is a perfect example of this number, the second part of your three-part process here.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's funny. I just something new, which, who knows, in a year, it may be irrelevant to my life. But right now, something that I've been doing a lot with, which actually made a little bit of difference, is, you know, have you read The Last Lecture by Randy Pausch?
I haven't. I saw the, are we talking about the one where the teacher gave the last lecture?
Yeah, yeah.
I actually saw the speech.
Okay. I haven't seen the speech. I read the book, and, you know, I got to tell you, as far as that genre of book goes, you know, I've read a lot, and most people in this industry have read a lot of those types of books. As far as books go, it wasn't really, I didn't really think it stood out amongst the others in terms of its content. But as I was reading it, and this is for people listening who don't know what it is, a Carnegie Mellon professor was diagnosed with a terminal cancer, no chance to live, and so he ended up, after he knew this, he gave a final lecture at Carnegie Mellon. It was very inspiring, and it was titled How to Live Your Childhood Dreams, and he wrote a book. And so as I'm reading this book, it was kind of average in a lot of context, but every so often I'd remind myself he wrote this when he knew he was about to die. You know, not someone who survived something terrible and then is reflecting back and then trying to capture, like, he's really, this is his attitude as he's, you know, death is a certainty for him. And in terms of this context of letting go, because I think that's what a lot of this is about, is letting go of the stuff you can't control, I found over the past few weeks, and this sounds somewhat morbid, but when I find myself, like, feeling depressed or stressed about stuff I can't control, I literally say to myself, well, you know, at least it's not pancreatic cancer.
Yep, hey, you know, it's a point of reference.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds awful, but, you know, it is perspective sometimes. It's like the stuff we let ourselves get stressed about. Like, oh, my God, what if this prospect doesn't buy my thing, or what if he doesn't like me, or what if he's in a bad mood? You know, you have to let that go. And the people, you know who you know who I hate? I hate those people who love sales. Not even like the kind, not you necessarily.
Of course not me.
I mean, you know the type of sales I'm talking about, like the cold calling sales, the people that love, they just get jazzed by it. And, you know, I hate them because I'm jealous of them, because I love that ability to detach that much, where they can just go in and, you know, no matter how bad a call it is, or whether, you know, it's a phone call or in person, you know, they just, it just bounces off of them, they move on to the next one. You know how that old sales adage of, like, you know, every no is one step closer to yes and all that stuff?
Yeah, I hate all that stuff. It's a numbers game. I think it's crap.
Yeah. Oh, I agree, too. But, you know, those people who live that have managed to embrace this principle of really just focusing on what they can control. They don't let their happiness be dictated by someone else. They don't let their success be dictated by someone else. They just keep plugging away, keeping themselves going. And while I agree from a sales perspective, I don't like that. I think it's too much work. It doesn't maximize. But in terms of this principle, you know, I think that is a mentality to be admired.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and again, you have to let it go. But they're striving towards a different thing. And a lot of times the challenge with people like that is they tend to be striving so much towards the number and getting the yes that they bulldoze customers into saying yes, and they miss the bigger picture, which is solving the problem, which a lot of them don't solve because they're trying to get to the wrong goal from my perspective.
Correct. So they miss the other parts of the process, the outcomes, the digging deeper and all that stuff. So, you know, realistically, if you can take a little piece of their mentality away and just do it in your own way, but yeah, focus on what you can control, let go of the rest, and most areas of your life will improve, guaranteed. All right, well, that is the five. And, you know, I just want to finish up by asking one more thing. And it is, as you know, and I talked about this a little bit in some of my blog posts and whatnot, but, you know, I developed this concept called the success reflex, which is that, you know, a lot of books, programs, speakers, coaches, consultants like to teach tactics. And we as people like to learn tactics, as in, what should I do here? And that's kind of what this step-by-step process is. But really, the whole point to my step-by-step process is to practice this until it becomes reflexive, so that it's not something you have to think about, but rather, when something unexpected happens, these things happen automatically and immediately.
When unexpected things happen, like a phone ringing in your house?
Yes, exactly, you know, which is a perfect thing right now. So, you know, I just focus on my outcome, which is having a good call, and I focus on what I could control, which is talking and saying yes and. So, I wasn't sure if that was loud enough for everyone to hear, but yes.
It was.
So, it's how do you respond reflexively? Because the problem is that a lot of times people will go through a program or something and be like, yeah, this is what I should do. But then, you know, when emotions are high or something happens, you know, you fall back on what your reflexive action is. And so, in my world, making those two mentalities reflexive and those three steps reflexive, so no matter what happens, that's a thought process you go to, is the key to success, hence the success reflex. And, you know, we've talked about how they apply to sales, but what I want to get your opinion on, and it may be something we already covered, I don't know, is from your experience, the people who do this really well, the sales conversations, the digging deeper, all this stuff, and people kind of like you do it really well, but sometimes a little harder to see it in yourself, but what are the things you think that they do reflexively? Just, they've done it so long, these are the people you might consider as naturals. What are the things they do just automatically and reflexively that we can learn from?
Well, first of all, they listen to what the client's actually saying, not the words that are coming out of their mouth, which I know sounds a little strange. But a lot of times the client, you've got to really pick up on the client trying to say something other than exactly what the words are saying for them. So, like, if you've got a customer who's got an issue, I'm trying to think of a good example here, but if you've got a customer who's saying things like, you know, that they've got this problem and they know this is an issue, and you really start listening, and a lot of times the problem isn't what they're saying it is. So you have to start asking questions to get to the actual root problem, not the surface issue. Again, I've got clients who are saying things like, you know, I have to have new clients. Why do you have new clients? Because I have, you know, I'm losing business. Why are you losing business? And then you ask enough questions, you start to realize that the problem is really that they're not getting along with their business partner. It's nothing to do with them picking up new clients. So as you see, you can tell by looking at people, and it becomes more of an instinct for you to start asking questions that go down different roads from where the client. Most of the time when you ask somebody what the problem is, it's not the problem. There's something else that's leading to the problem. So figuring out what's causing it is what the real issue is. But in this country specifically, you know, we're real big on, oh, you have a headache, take a Tylenol. When the real problem isn't that you have a headache, the real problem is that something is causing the headache, and if you don't fix what the thing is that's causing the headache, you're going to continue having headaches no matter how many Tylenol you take. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. And if you can be, you know, if you're selling something to someone, if you can be that solution, you know, solving the disease and not the symptom, then you can be more valuable and happier. So let me ask you this. So that level of in-depth listening is something that I know that you do reflexively and the people who do this well do reflexively. How would you suggest someone who is new to this concept and they're going in on a sales call, just what is like one thing they can do to practice this? And you know, it may be as obvious as just telling them to do it, but do you have any ways people remember, any tips, anything to just get to that point where this becomes reflective? So
one of the easiest things to do, no matter what your instinct is to say, no matter what the client answers with, if you could try to follow up with it, well, why do you think that? Or why is that true? Or what evidence do you have to support that? And what you're trying to do, and your brain needs to start really wrapping around this, is to try to find the root cause, to try to find the rationale behind why the person is making the decision he or she is making. And if you can understand why people are behaving the way they're behaving, it makes all the more sense. So if you're in a sales call, or even if you're just hanging out with your spouse or your significant other or your kids, and they're crying or whining about something, if you can sit there and think, why are they behaving this way, or why do they want this thing, or why are they whining about this thing, it'll open up a whole new door for you. So, I mean, I know when I'm talking to one of my really dearest friends, a lot of times I'll ask him what's wrong, and he'll say, I don't know. And one of the best tricks I ever learned when somebody comes back with, I don't know, is to say, if you had to guess, what would it be? And what it does is it lets them off the hook to coming up with an actual answer and allows them to be wrong if they could give an answer if they're guessing. And it opens up all sorts of stuff, because then you start to get to the root behind why it is that they think this is a problem or why it is that they're upset.
Well, that's also a phenomenal sales question, right? I mean, if you say, what do you think the biggest problem here at this company is? Well, I don't know. You had to guess.
Yep.
Or,
what would it be?
Whatever you're trying to get to.
Yep.
That's a great. So that's awesome. So asking the why, you know, why do you think that, or if you had to guess.
Or what evidence do you have to support it, or what leads you to that conclusion, or something along those lines, something that's natural for you.
And that's also stuff you can practice. You don't have to be on a sales call to practice doing it. Which
no,
I think is the best, because, I mean.
Bar. Yeah, if you've had two beers, start doing this and see how far you can get with your friends before they realize you've done it. Most of the times, my friends don't even see it coming. I'm practicing on them all the time.
I love it. I love stuff you can practice at a bar. So this is perfect technique, really. Everyone, I think I'm going to practice this technique tonight. I invite everyone else. And really, frankly, no matter when you're listening to this, I'm probably going to be out practicing this technique tonight.
I love giving you things you can practice in bars.
That's really the best kind of practice at all. Because if you can do it at a bar, it's got to be simple enough to do anyway. So
yeah, absolutely. If you can do something after you've had two or three drinks and it's that natural and that easy to do, you can absolutely do it when you're nervous at a sales call.
Excellent. Not that we're advocating you run out and start getting loaded to practice stuff.
No,
I hope
also
you understand.
Not advocating you get loaded before your next sales call either.
That's true. That's true. But, you know, but if you're at like a, you know, sometimes you go to dinner with clients.
There you go.
You have a glass or two of wine. You don't want, like, a complicated sales script you have to remember to go through.
No, and honestly, I mean, we're joking about this a lot, but honestly, the conversation you have with your client in the sales call should be no more difficult than the conversation you'd have with a friend over a glass of wine and dinner.
That's perfect. Well, all right then. Cool. Well, that is a lot of information. And that is all I have. I want to thank you for taking the time to chat with me about this and sharing your a lot of knowledge. It's actually making me go back and think about some of the stuff I'm doing in my business. You know, this was supposed to educate other people, but you know, even though I've known you for years, I still feel like I learned something with this call. So thank you very much for that.
Oh, good.
And did you want to share any propaganda website, anything with us?
OrangeTree123.com is your best bet for finding information out about me, Kirsten Carey, and what other mind manipulation, communication, sales things I have going on. And you can get right to my blog by going on there as well.
Great. So go to OrangeTree123.com to check out Kirsten. And be sure to check out MotivationalSmartAss.com to read my blog and to get more audios like this. And once again, thank you very much, Kirsten, and we'll be talking soon.
Okay.